From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the latest round of primaries are over. Voters from California to New Jersey now know who will be on the ballot in the all-important midterm elections in November. Let's start with NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. He's been sifting these tea leaves. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Robin.
And first of all, just a broad brush. Democrats hoping to flip the House, maybe even the Senate. Republicans hoping to hold on to their power. What do the results show you in terms of, let's say, in cases of like turnout?
Well, Democrats have to be breathing a sigh of relief this morning because over the last several months, we've seen Republicans actually wind up doing better, overall with the national landscape, President Trump's approval rating ticking up, and that's a really key indicator. And what we saw in California, for example, last night, Democrats, despite the number of candidates in those races, some key races that Democrats need to compete in this fall in order to have a chance to take back the House, what we saw was Democrats actually seem to have gotten through all of their candidates, especially in three notable races. They were very concerned about one of those races and about not getting their person through because of this top two primary system where the top two vote getters, regardless of party, wind up getting through to the general election.
Well, so tell us what happened, because Democrats invested a lot of money to try to get a candidate to run against the Republicans, Dana Rohrabacher or Ed Royce or Daryl Issa. So how did they fare?
Well, they wound up, again, getting all of their candidates through, it appears. We're not going to know final results probably for several days. But that's a big thing because there are seven seats that Hillary Clinton won that Republicans hold currently in California. And Democrats really need those seats or at least be able to compete in most of them to be able to have a chance. When you look across the country at a lot of these House races last night, look at New Jersey, for example. In suburban seats, like in California, affluent voters, well-educated voters, Democrats need to do well in those places. And they were able to get through a lot of candidates who the Democratic national operatives think are the best candidates who give them the best chance to win in those places this fall.
Even if let's stay with New Jersey for a second, because even if it's Senator Robert Menendez, who, you know, had quite a lot of ethics questions when as he went into this race, Lisa McCormick, an unknown candidate, no federal finance filings, no television ads. No real campaign got 40% of the Democratic primary vote against him.
Yeah, so Democrats had good news in the House, but not so good news in the Senate last night because of that. Democrats, are here with Robert Menendez, who was embattled and wound up being charged and accused of corruption, even though he was not being convicted of those charges. But that was a lackluster showing last night, just over 60% for the Democratic incumbent and the Senate Foreign Relations Chairman, and that could open up a seat for Republicans to target. And they have a candidate who's well-funded, a former pharmaceutical CEO who spent $7.5 million of his own money on ads, calling Menendez morally unfit for office. So this is a seat now that Republicans are feeling a little bit better about, that they might be able to put on the map in a year where they've got a pretty good map in the Senate.
And what about in Alabama with the Republicans and Representative Martha Roby? Now, this is somebody who she backed all of Trump's policies, building the wall, the president's tax bill. But she didn't back him when he was running for president because of his comments after the Access Hollywood video came out. Yeah. And it seems like she got punished. She did not secure her seat. She's going to have a runoff.
She drew a very strong primary challenge from a former congressman, Bobby Bright. And the catch here, though, is that Bright was a former Democrat when he served in Congress.
Right.
Now, that's not unusual for a lot of Democrats to change to be Republicans in the South culturally. But he is somebody who voted for Nancy Pelosi to be Speaker, and that's something that's going to come back to him. But you're right that she only got 37% of the vote so far, and that shows the limits of being able to speak out against President Trump, especially in a district that he won by 30 points.
I just have to ask you, the Trump-backed John Cox got a spot in the California gubernatorial race. Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom won the Democratic nomination. He ran ads touting Cox's conservatism. He thinks that's going to be a handicap. Your thoughts there?
Well, look, President Trump's taking a little bit of credit this morning, saying that he was able to get Cox through because Republicans were very concerned that they weren't going to get anyone through, that there might be two Democrats, which would have reduced turnout, could have helped Democrats, oddly enough, down the line for those House races because it would have potentially depressed Republican turnout. So Cox gets through. Republicans, though, shut out for the second straight Senate cycle in a Senate seat where they did not get someone through to the general election.
Okay, we'll keep looking at all of this. NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro, all day. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, medicine and politics are colliding in Pennsylvania. A bill making its way through the legislature has split a community brought together by a common diagnosis, and it could be the next front in the abortion debate. Shai Ben-Yakov from member station WHYY in Philadelphia reports.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Lynn and Kevin Edis of Northwest Philadelphia had a difficult time starting a family.
I actually had three miscarriages before I became pregnant with Hazel. And
that's Hazel playing on the floor with her dad. Hazel is 20 months old. When I arrive, she smiles and waves at me. And while she can't yet walk, she squirms and rolls around the room with ease. Hazel has Down syndrome. Her diagnosis was a shock for both parents.
I remember being at work, and Kevin and I at the time worked together, and the genetic counselor called me, and I left the office, and I went over to Kevin's desk, and I was crying.
Many parents in this situation say their world shifts at the moment they get the diagnosis. There are a million questions. Can I give this child what they need? Who will take care of them when I'm gone?
And you think to yourself, can I handle this?
Lynn and Kevin decided to move forward with the pregnancy. A few months later, Hazel was born.
You know, I think all that worry we had beforehand went away the second she was born. And, we fell in love with her right away, obviously.
Have all the members voted? The clerk will record the vote. The yeas are 139, the nays are 56.
In April, Pennsylvania lawmakers approved a bill that would ban abortions in cases like Hazel's, where there was a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome. It has yet to be taken up in the Senate, and the governor has said he would veto it if it reached his desk. Similar laws have already passed in four other states. Two, in Ohio and Indiana, have been suspended following court challenges from the ACLU. The bill is creating a divide within the Down syndrome community. Lynn and Kevin Edis love their daughter, but they don't support this bill.
I believe that it's a woman's right to choose to keep a child or not. We made the right choice for us. I don't think that it's the government's right to tell somebody that they have to have a child because they have a certain diagnosis.
But advocates like Jeremy Samick frame the bill as anti-discrimination legislation. He's senior counsel with the Pennsylvania Family Institute. The group points to places like Iceland, where nearly all such pregnancies are terminated.
When they promote it, they talk about it being an eradication of Down syndrome as if they've eradicated a disease. But we would never say that we've eradicated homelessness by eradicating homeless people, right? And I think that's essentially what they're doing here.
Samick speaks from a position at an organization opposed to abortion, but he also speaks as a parent of a child with Down syndrome.
For our daughter, we adopted her. She's doing wonderful. She engages everybody she meets, smiles at strangers, waves at strangers, talks to strangers.
At the heart of this debate is a question. Can the government stop parents from choosing which children to have? It's not an easy one to answer. In Pennsylvania, there's only one restriction on abortion, says Temple University law professor Rachel Rebichet.
There are eight states, I think, that have sex-selective abortion bans.
Pennsylvania is one of eight states where you can't terminate a pregnancy because of the sex of the baby. In two of those eight, Illinois and Indiana, the laws have been halted by federal judges. Rebichet says these cases will likely wind their way through the courts, possibly as far as the Supreme Court.
I think that, you know, if you ask most people, should people be able to terminate pregnancies for any reason? And what about if the reason's, you know, eye color or sex, gender, you know, people start to have very complicated reactions.
When we look at the word eugenics itself, this fits squarely within that box.
Again, Jeremy Samick.
It's an effort to look at society and say, this is what we think the standard of perfection is when it comes to human beings. And those kind of things ought not happen.
All of the parents I spoke with agree. Their children have enriched their lives. But the most vociferous critics of this legislation argue it has nothing to do with Down syndrome. Rabbi Mordechai Liebling is a liberal activist who also has a 27-year-old son with Down syndrome.
I think it's reprehensible that they are using children with Down syndrome, you know, as a wedge in this issue.
Temple's Rachel Rebuchet agrees lawmakers pushing the bill seem to have an underlying motive.
It's clear that these laws are being passed by Republican legislators based on model legislation that Americans United for the Defense of Life publishes. The laws are designed to really test the constitutional claims that attach to abortion.
And when the bill's sponsor, Pennsylvania House Speaker Mike Terzai, talked about the bill on the House floor, he talked about more than just Down syndrome.
In the end, abortion is a violent act, not against potential life, but against a living, growing human being, a life with potential.
If the bill does become law, abortion rights groups are vowing to fight it in court. For Here and Now, I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov.
I took a trip last month to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, to visit a high school friend who's an emergency physician there.
Hi there.
Hello.
I'm Dr. Grossman.
I know Dr. Grossman as Daniel Grossman. He's 37, and he's talking to a patient who says he's been fatigued and having heart palpitations.
Well, I just noticed I had gotten a bad cold, and so I was in bed a couple of days, and I could tell my heart was skipping beats all the time. So I'm like, I've been in several times and had all kinds of tests done on my heart.
Okay. You
know, after a few more questions, Daniel recommends some blood work.
So the reality is we probably won't come up with a specific answer today, which I recognize is pretty frustrating. But we'll do our best to see if we can get some things started and some of the more, you know, obvious things crossed off the list for you. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
What you can't hear is that both the patient and the doctor are in wheelchairs. The patient, because he's visiting the emergency room, and the doctor, because of a spinal cord injury less than a year ago. And he's already back to work. Daniel's memories of the accident are fuzzy. He was mountain biking with his friend Ron last September in northern Minnesota. It was the end of the day, and they decided to take one more run.
Ron was in front of me, and I was following behind him. And the next thing I know, I woke up with people around me.
You don't remember what happened?
No idea. I think I went up a little hill, and that's about it.
You're a doctor, obviously. Did you try to self-diagnose as you were trying to figure out what had happened?
At some point, and the timing of it is a little bit shady, we called my brother from the trail, and my brother's a neurologist. And I said, Aaron, I can't feel my legs. And he said, well, ask Ron if you're moving your legs. Ron, am I moving my legs? He's like, no. And my back hurt. So putting two and two together, we figured there was a spinal cord injury.
And did you realize right away that you may not walk again?
I would say it took me to the helicopter to realize that.
Daniel was airlifted to a hospital in Minneapolis, where he learned he had suffered a spinal cord injury between his 7th and 8th thoracic vertebrae. He was paralyzed below his mid-abdomen, just a few inches above his belly button. He survived because he was wearing a helmet. He spent 4.5 months in 3 hospitals and has had to relearn to do basic things like lifting himself from his bed to his wheelchair, and things that aren't talked about as much, like going to the bathroom when you can't feel the lower half of your body. Daniel has to time his bathroom breaks based on what he's had to eat and drink and carries an extra pair of pants just in case. He's also had to renovate his apartment so he can do things many of us take for granted.
We have created a cutout under the sink. We've also created a fully wheel-in bathroom shower so that I can move easily in a special shower commode chair from a toilet into the shower. We've added grab bars, and we've tried to make things as safe as possible.
He puts that special wheelchair on the right side of his bed at night so he can get to it in the morning. After showering, he returns to his bed, gets dressed there, and then his primary wheelchair is on the other side of his bed so he can go to work. He's also made some adjustments to the rest of his apartment, raising the dining room table so he can get his wheelchair underneath, lowering the sink so he can clean dishes on his own, and he relies heavily on technology, using Amazon's Alexa for things that will save him a couple of wheelchair transfers, like turning on and off the lights.
Alexa will turn on my TV. Alexa will change the temperature in the room. Alexa will lock the door.
You also have started relying on Instacart.
So I'm happy to go to the grocery store. It just is a fairly inefficient process to get out of my car, load some groceries, and, you know, get back in the car. If I can limit the number of transfers and use a food delivery service, I will. I realize that not everyone has access to all of these things, and I think that's really important to remember.
Daniel's on a doctor's salary, but on average, being disabled costs people thousands of dollars a year, and many need to rely more on friends and family. Daniel's parents moved into town for 6 months after his accident to help him.
There was a moment after your parents had been here for a while when you apologized to your father.
So my parents are in their 70s. They have essentially retired from their jobs as university professors. And part of that retirement plan was likely not to have their son have a life-changing injury. I said, Dad, this isn't what you planned for your retirement, and I'm really sorry about that. I apologize that you are here with me instead of doing the things that I think you should be doing. And he, for the first time I've seen it, broke down in tears and was visibly angry with me and said, don't ever apologize again. This is what I signed up for the day you were born. This is my role as a father. Don't ever apologize again.
In February, just 5 months after his accident, Daniel went back to work at two jobs. He's medical director of the health insurance startup Bright Health, and four times a month, he pulls shifts as an ER doctor at the Mayo Clinic. To get to work these days, he commutes an hour and a half from Minneapolis to Rochester, Minnesota for his ER shifts, and he drives himself.
So I pull up to the car, lock my brakes, and then hop in. Typically, my legs spasm a little bit as we go here.
The whole process takes just under 5 minutes. He has to lift himself into the car, then take apart his wheelchair and put it in the back seat.
I'm telling you, these YouTube guys make it look like the simplest thing in the world. I buckle my seatbelt so I don't fall out. What I've learned through all of this is life is one big experiment, and you just have to figure out what works for you.
Once he's on the road, Daniel uses a system of hand controls to drive.
There's a knob on the wheel that I'm using with my left hand, and I'm using the hand controls with my right hand. I elected to get right-sided hand controls instead of left-sided hand controls because I'm so tall that with the left-sided hand controls, my knees would always hit the rods that go underneath it. And now we're just driving like normal.
Driving like normal to a job that is anything but, even for someone who isn't paralyzed.
Getting back to work as an emergency physician initially seemed like a pretty big hurdle. You run around a lot. You're doing procedures that require awkward positioning over the patient, whether that's putting in a large IV in someone's neck or groin called a central line, or whether putting in a breathing tube when someone is having difficulty breathing called an intubation. All of these are situations that you find yourself in that are critical and that require you to sort of adapt your positioning based on the situation.
Because usually the doctor would be standing up and looking down at the patient when they do something like that?
Standing up and looking down, moving around, moving their head and body.
So what did you do about that?
When it was time to get back practicing and trying things, we did what's called simulation. We take mannequins and we can practice intubating them or doing central lines or doing lumbar punctures, a spinal tap. We also set up patient rooms in the ER at Mayo and had mock patients, usually like a friend's kids. so I could learn how to navigate the room.
So this is teaching you the technical aspects. What about when you started finally interacting with patients? Was there a difference by the fact that you wheeled into the room?
Some are flabbergasted. Some are rude to me. And that has been like the minority of patients. Little kids have asked me, why are you in a wheelchair? And it's opened up a conversation about accidents, about life-saving use of helmets. It's also very clearly broken down barriers with patients because they know that you have gone through something. And so they're much more willing to listen to you when you offer advice. You can relate to them, maybe not specifically to their situation, but you can find a way to relate to the fact that they're going through health problems.
Because this is a big complaint about doctors in general, is that people feel that they're thinking about everything technically and they don't have enough emotion or empathy for the patient.
Yeah, there's an empathy that's missing in medicine. And it's not taught in medical schools. Mm. And it's not taught in residency. And I will be the first to say that I have not led the most empathetic clinical practice that I could have. I think I've done a poor job of caring for patients with spinal cord injuries. And I think my injury has changed my practice. I understand that a patient is scared. I understand that their family members don't have a clue about what's going on. When I say, I know your life is about to change or is changing today, they look at me and they know that I know what I'm talking about.
Hmm.
And it's pretty emotional.
Tomorrow, we'll continue our visit with Daniel and hear about a mentor he's had through his recovery, another Mayo Clinic doctor who's also in a wheelchair because of a spinal cord injury.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
The genealogy site MyHeritage has become the latest victim of a security breach. The website allows people to create family trees. They can also submit a spit sample for genetic testing through MyHeritage DNA. Megan Thielking is a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. And Megan, MyHeritage might not be as well known a genealogy site as Ancestry.com, but still, there are 92 million accounts compromised. Now, the company's saying it was just emails, not the genetic data that was hacked?
Yeah, so MyHeritage says that someone found the email addresses and hashed passwords, which are like concealed passwords, of every user that had signed up before October of last year in a private server that wasn't theirs. Obviously, that's raised concerns about the security of the more sensitive data that they have. But for now, they say they have no reason to believe that any other information, like people's genetic data, has been compromised.
But you write an interesting thing about how researchers at the University of Washington encoded a strand of DNA to put malware in it. And they took remote control of a computer that was being used to process genetic data, not at MyHeritage, but somewhere else. So this can be done. And these researchers concluded that in many of these cases where DNA information is being collected, the best practices for security are not being used.
Certainly, researchers have raised concerns about the vulnerabilities of these companies. Most of the big companies say that they have security steps in place, like they keep usernames and passwords in one system and they keep genetic information in another system so that they can't be associated with one another. But I think this case and that study that you mentioned both show that genealogy platforms can be vulnerable to security breaches just like any other company that's online could be.
Well, and also just vulnerable because we're reminded of the recent case where investigators in California were able to find the Golden State Killer suspect in part because of a genealogy platform and a relative of his that had gone on and they did a DNA comparison. So people might have jitters about this.
Right. And I think there are sort of two intertwined concerns with that, which is security and also privacy. So this MyHeritage situation has sparked a lot of concerns about whether the data that you give to companies is really secure. But the Golden State Killer case really sparked a conversation about privacy and how much privacy consumers can really expect when they submit their spit to these companies, and whether consumers really understand whether their data could be used in a criminal investigation.
And so what is MyHeritage saying about what they're going to do because of this breach?
The company has said it's investigating it, obviously, and it'll hire a cybersecurity firm to look into it and make some recommendations about its security. And it's also planning to speed up its work to roll out two-factor authentication, which is supposed to make the whole login process more secure. But also today, the company announced that it's going to forcibly expire everyone's password so that everyone who's on MyHeritage will need a new password to log in.
That's 92 million people. But meantime, you spoke to a professor at Sarah Lawrence College who said that, you know, when we say DNA and privacy and security, we all get nervous, but maybe that's an overreaction in some ways.
Yeah, she raised an interesting point that there's still a question of, you know, if someone hacked your DNA, what would they necessarily do with it? And would employers and insurers really discriminate against people based on DNA that's been illegally procured in some way? Her point, which I thought was an interesting one, was that it's really more of a concern that someone's credit card information might be stolen.
Megan Thielking of STAT, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Anthony Valadez is a DJ at KCRW. He's with us once again from Santa Monica. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Jeremy. How are you?
Doing well. And as we get ready to kick off summer officially here, let's listen to some of the music that you brought us, starting with a singer-songwriter from South London, Jacob Allen, who goes by the name Puma Blue. This is called Moon Underwater.
Moon underwater. You will not know what to do with the words you drink from the room. You flirt, it's good the way you treat your boy. The poor son is so in love with a sexy little thing. She's just a teen.
Interesting sound there. How would you describe this?
How would I describe this? I would say very moody, melodic, dark, and I love the jazzy chords. I love how dark it is. And one of the things I acknowledge, or that I love about his work, is that he admits he doesn't have a great voice, but he says, I mean, I love his voice personally, but he said something to the effect of, you know I'm not D'Angelo, but I know that I can make it work. And I've always appreciated that. The way he mixes this lo-fi darkness, and it's just, it's very moving. And another funny thing is, you know, when I was trying to look him up at first, I'm like, okay, Puma Blue. All these shoes came up, and I'm like, no, I don't want to buy blue Pumas. I'm trying to find this artist. So.
You don't want blue Pumas. Well, and he says that he's been playing live music since he was 10 years old. What did you learn about him?
I've just learned about his music. I think I was turned on to his Bandcamp page. And he put out this EP called Swoon Baby. And it's almost like he hits chords that don't necessarily belong together, but it works and it sounds magical.
Okay, well, the next one you brought us is the artist Rick Wilson out of Chicago. This is Love Away.
And I know that we are reaching our gloom or a rough in our bloom, but I think that love still got room. So don't you say goodbye way too soon. So promise to me that you won't go. Promise to me that you'll try to hold on still. And maybe we can stay together, make it through whichever weather, forever. Don't you take your love away. I know times are changing, but promise me that you'll try to stay.
Sounds very sincere there, trying to get somebody to not break up with him.
Boy, do I know that feeling. I mean, when, you know, when anytime you hear about Chicago in the news, you hear about the violence and the guns. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what he's singing about love, and I think that's a great juxtaposition. But most importantly, I've been talking to a lot of artists out of Chicago, and there's this movement happening. It's called the Chicago Renaissance. You've got folks like Chance the Rapper, Raven Lanae, Knox Fortune, Vic Mensa, who are very, they're activists, but most importantly, they're pushing boundaries with music. That song specifically, you're listening to this rapper sing, and you're listening, there are no drums, and he's preaching about love, and I love what's happening in Chicago. He describes himself as having nonchalant swagger, and I love that.
Who is Rick Wilson?
Rick Wilson is a 20-year-old kid who dropped out of college to make music. He's putting out this EP entitled Bamba on an LA label known as Innovative Leisure. And he's just a very positive guy. Every time I play his music on KCRW, he gets excited and he loves it. It's really cool to see his excitement. Wow, I'm being played on the radio. Hmm. And I think that's so fresh and nice. And shout out to Chicago and the Chicago Renaissance.
Well, and if he's listening in Chicago, he'll hear this right now. So let's go next to Melbourne, Australia, where sadly Here Now is not on. This is the group Jala with Long Live. Anthony, our producer, Jill, says this sounds to her like Gwen Stefani. What do you think?
Yeah, I can definitely hear that. To me, I feel like she's almost 1980s cable access TV, New York City, Glenn O'Brien's TV party. It's very raw. It goes back to Puma Blue, where she also plays with these chords, and there's a lot of jazz, there's a lot of punk, there's a lot of rock. And what's interesting as well is she used to be a roommate with Napalm of the Grammy-nominated band Hiatus Coyote. And you can hear a lot of similarities in the sound. But yeah, she's out of Melbourne. And there's a lot of incredible things happening, musically speaking, out of Melbourne.
And should we know anything else about Jala?
She has a record that just dropped. She's known, or she used to be known, for drinking a lot of beer and getting naked and recording music. And now hopefully she has her stuff together and I hope she keeps creating musical babies, because I'm a big fan.
Okay, and we finish with a song from where you are, an LA artist, Bardo Martinez. This is called Love of Mine.
Love of mine, now is the time that I dedicate myself to your embrace. You're my one, my lovely one, my only love on earth under the sun. Love of mine.
A nice summer song.
Absolutely. Bartolo Martinez, who should be noted, is the frontman of the LA band Chicano Batman. And he's got this charm. He's an extension of a soul movement we had in LA known as Chicano Soul, known for in the 60s and 70s. Music that was very popular amongst the Cholo culture that has a great history in Los Angeles. And I just love this throwback sound to the 60s soul movement. Mm-hmm. And then there's the sound effects of space. It's almost like Sun Ra. You're pushing yesterday with tomorrow. And he's such a great guy. So I'm happy he's putting out new music.
A lot of artists doing that right now, using that 60s throwback at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that, you know, Amy Winehouse, Rafael Sadiq, right. And Bartolo Martinez, though, is just having so much success with Chicano Batman, and I love that he's taking a step back and kind of putting out his own thing. And it's funny, if you follow him on social media, he'll do some freestyling rap or he'll mess around. So I love that he's very open with his audience and he's growing, and I can't wait to hear more Chicano Batman. They're touring all the time, so it's nice to see him step back and put out his own stuff.
Well, Anthony, while we have you, I have to ask you about the one song that's just getting so much attention right now, just socially as well as musically. It's Childish Gambino's This Is America. Have you been thinking about it, or what do you think of it?
I love it. I play it in the clubs when I DJ, and it's nice to see that positive message light up a room. I love the video. I love what's happening aesthetically, and I love the little tidbits. I love that there are think pieces about this video. Mm-hmm. I find it interesting that, you know, when we grew up in hip-hop, you would have to go to the Source magazine to kind of find out the little interesting tidbits, and now you have NPR, now you have Here and Now, and folks talking about this. We now see hip-hop being discussed outside of its bubble, and I love that it's creating dialogue, and the think pieces are incredible. The Pulitzer Prize, Kendrick Lamar, you know, now... It's so incredible, and I love that this conversation is expanding beyond just the hip-hop community.
Well, and hip-hop, by the way, now the number one music genre in the world.
Are you surprised by that? I'm not. I've always been a big fan.
Yeah, I mean, but it is kind of amazing.
I mean, it's funny, too, that 10, 15 years ago, club owners would throw us out of the club for playing hip-hop.
Hmm.
And now your daughter's listening to it. That makes me feel really happy.
It's Anthony Valadez, a DJ at KCRW. Anthony, thanks as always.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you can find all our DJ session picks on Spotify. It's NPR Here and Now, and we're on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping
now. Look what I'm whipping up. A couple of years ago, a Nashville pediatrician started a Facebook group for women like her, specifically doctors of South Asian heritage living in North America who were also mothers. The DACI Physician Moms Group was a space to share the frustrations and the joys of work, family, travel. But slowly, stories of domestic violence also began to surface. Today, the group has helped dozens of women leave abusive relationships. Natasha Sanyanovich from member station WPLN in Nashville has this story.
Vidya Bansal's refrigerator is full of cards from members thanking her for the support they've received from the group.
I'm grateful to my sister who introduced me to this women physicians group, and I was struggling to find my worth and self-value at 48 years with grown children. These are physician women who are looking to find their value and self-worth.
Bansal was born in Nashville to Indian parents. She's a Desi, a person of South Asian birth or descent who lives abroad. Bansal started the group, she says, because doctors spend their entire adult lives either studying or practicing medicine, which can be isolating. All the more so for women who've moved to North America from highly patriarchal societies, where even the most affluent can go straight from their family home to their husband's home. And when that new home is an unhappy or violent one, leaving is often the last option.
The problem is twofold when it comes to Desi victims of domestic abuse. One is the social stigma where you don't just leave him. You don't just get a divorce.
Bansal says there's also a gender inequity so deeply rooted that many Desi women think they should be subservient to their husbands. Yet she was still shocked when more and more highly accomplished women began shyly asking the group if slapping, choking, or even just emotional abuse from a husband was normal, like one pediatrician in her 30s who lives in Indiana.
I thought, you know, why not ask women who are just like me? They grew up in the same culture, they have the same level of education, and they should have an understanding of whether this is acceptable or not. And I posted anonymously, and then the responses I got were so overwhelming, and they all said, this is not normal, this is not how it works in our household.
We're not using this woman's name at the request of her lawyer. She says Bansal, in particular, held her hand, virtually, for 18 months before she gained the courage to file for divorce. After she did, her husband of a dozen years threatened to take their 3-year-old daughter back to India. So she packed 2 bags.
My laptop bag with just work stuff and then just a little purse with, you know, a few clothes thrown in and my documents.
And she and the girl crawled out of a window one morning last year. Despite her professional success, she stayed with her husband much longer than she wanted to, she says, in part for her family back in India. She'd already had a so-called love marriage to a man she met on her own in a country where more than 80% of marriages are still arranged.
So in my case, it would be both those insults, as they would call it, if I were to divorce. So I kind of took it upon myself, and I just, you know, didn't want them to be worried or get hurt by my personal choices.
She also waited until her sister in India got married so that she wouldn't be stigmatized either. Even thousands of miles away, the physician was deeply entrenched in the traditions of her culture, which can be wonderful, says Pakistani-born attorney and activist Kazir Khan.
But when it comes to
culture making you indignified, making you a second-class citizen, that is violation of your basic dignity and basic humanity.
Khan is best known as the man whose son was killed during the Iraq War and who challenged candidate Donald Trump to brush up on the Constitution at the 2016 Democratic National Convention. Khan has become a mentor to the Facebook group and says the legal and human rights of these women must become a top priority of conversation among families, social organizations, even the legal community in America. But he especially wants to see Muslim and Hindu religious leaders overcome their reluctance to address the issue.
This problem is so pervasive that the conversation should be equally pervasive. It should be spoken with the loudest voice, that no need to suffer quietly, no need to suffer.
To that end, the Desi Physician Moms launched a foundation last year based in Nashville. It's raised more than $30,000 so far to cover court fees of victims who leave abusive homes. And at the urging of Khan, the foundation helps all Desi women, not just doctors. Meanwhile, the original Facebook group now counts more than 6,000 members. As it continues to expand, a subgroup dedicated to domestic violence sees at least one new member daily, says the pediatrician from Indiana.
We are a thick group of friends now, and we share anything. You know, it can be like really personal, and we have a place that we are so confident, and we feel safe in sharing.
That, she says, is a privilege not many women in her position have. For Here and Now, I'm Natasha Sinjanovic.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.